Frank Aaron. I'm resident scholar at the American Bankruptcy Institute. This series of conversations we're having with people who work in the bankruptcy field as we try to understand what they do and how they do it. For today's conversation, we recall Alfonso X, the King of Spain, who said, had I been present at the creation, I could have made some valuable suggestions. Rich Levin has as good a claim as any man alive to have been present at the creation of modern bankruptcy law. As a young staff member working for the Judiciary Committee in the House of Representatives, he was a scrivener for what became the Bankruptcy Act of 1978. He's had a distinguished career since then, and lately he's developed some strong views about how bankruptcy law is changing. Rich, welcome to ABI Podcast.
Thanks, Jack.
Shall we go back to the beginning and sketch out your career here? As I said, the first I ever heard of you was working for the House Judiciary Committee.
That's right. I went there right after law school and was totally green and uneducated in bankruptcy law, as most staffers are on whatever they take up, many young staffers on the Hill who learn on the job.
Had you taken a bankruptcy course in law school?
I had. I'd taken the bankruptcy course from J.W. Moore, who was one of the great bankruptcy scholars of prior generations, and I stress prior even at the time I was in law school. He was the editor-in-chief of Collier on Bankruptcy through the 50s and 60s, I'd taken that class, and I'd worked during my second summer of law school at a bankruptcy boutique, so I had a little bit of familiarity with the topic.
And tell me how you got the job.
One of those being in the right place at the right time, for every job on Capitol Hill at the time, and I think it's probably still true, there were at least 300 applicants. I had some interest in bankruptcy law based on the course in my summer clerkship the prior summer before graduation. And so I wanted to go to Washington to work out of law school, preferably Capitol Hill rather than just going straight to practice law. And George Treister, who was at the one of the names in the firm that I worked at, suggested that Congress might be taking up a revision of the bankruptcy law because the Commission on the Bankruptcy Laws of the United States had filed its report to Congress a year or so prior, year and a half prior, and Congress got deterred by small matters such as the impeachment of President Nixon and the confirmation of the vice presidency Gerald Ford and Nelson Rockefeller, and so bankruptcy kind of got pushed to the back, and the staffer that I ultimately wound up working for, Alan Parker, I contacted him, and he said he was trying to hire somebody to do bankruptcy law, but he hadn't gotten authorization, and he would keep me in mind, and just within weeks before I graduated, he got the authorization, and of those 300 applicants who applied for that job, I was probably the only one applying to what was then called the Subcommittee on Civil and Constitutional Rights, who said he was interested in working on bankruptcy law. That was before anybody thought anything of bankruptcy law other than, why would you go do that?
I said in my intro that you were the scrivener. Did I get that right? Were you the guy with the pen that was pounding stuff down?
I was the guy with the pen. I used a typewriter,
okay.
An old IBM Selectric typewriter to draft the code, and then it got hand edited a lot and sent over to GPO. But yeah, I was the scrivener. I drafted everything with a lot of editing help from other people. I don't mean to say that I was the sole scrivener.
Yes, we should say with your distinguished colleague Ken Klee, too.
Who was an extraordinary editor. We had complementary talents. I could draft pretty well, but I couldn't see the holes in the draft. Ken couldn't draft to save his life, but he could find every hole. And so between the two of us, we covered quite a lot of ground.
So you were there how long? What, 2 years?
Almost three years.
Yeah. Bankruptcy Act finally passed in what, fall of 78?
Fall of 78, effective date of October 1st, 79.
Were you still there in the fall of 78, or had you moved on by that point?
I had moved on, but was still working for the committee as a consultant, to finish the conference with the Senate and get the final product through the House.
Am I right that you'd gone to California to practice law at that point?
I did. I went back to the bankruptcy boutique that I had worked for in my summer in law school called Stubman, Treister & Glatt.
You said a few minutes ago that when you came out of law school you were thinking you might not practice law, but here you are practicing law apparently.
Yeah, well, you know, things change. We learn, as one of my friends used to say, old German proverb, too soon we get old, too late we get smart.
Life is what happens when you're planning something else, they say.
That's true.
You told me the other day when we were chatting about this, about in your early time at Stedman that you told me about ITEL. Let's talk about ITEL.
ITEL was one of the first really major cases under the then new bankruptcy code. It was filed in January of 1981, so the code was a little over a year old. There had been some other pretty big cases, but this one really seemed to be the first major case with major financial institutions involved at all levels. There were three or four different flavors of very large slugs of debt and other obligations. There was unsecured bank debt. There were leveraged leases for rail cars and containers. There was secured debt. And it was a very complex case with several subsidiaries and a lot of fraud in the financial reporting.
Maybe we should review the bidding. What did ITEL do?
ITEL had two main businesses. The healthier business was that it leased shipping containers and rail cars. And the less healthy business, and ultimately that business is still going. You can look on the road nowadays and still see ITEL containers running around and ITEL rail cars. After the reorganization, it continued to operate and was ultimately bought by Sam Zell, or one of his entities. The other business, which was the famous and then notorious business, was leasing large mainframe computers, which this was before the day of PCs. If you remember, PCs were introduced in 1981 or 1982. So we're talking through the 70s here, leasing large mainframe computers in lease transactions. Let's say the accounting for them was creative and aggressive. And it was a very high-flying company in San Francisco in the 1970s. Very plush offices all over the news, and it came crashing down hard when the accounting fraud and financial disclosure fraud was uncovered.
So you're here in 81 as, what would that be, a second-year associate or something?
A little more than that since I've been out of law school a few years.
Okay. Well, how precisely was your role in a major case like this as a young associate?
I had two roles during the case. The first was...
I guess I should say as a rather unusual young associate. But,
I probably knew the code better than most of the other associates working on the case. But my two roles were, first, I managed the operational side. When this was in the day before there were first day orders, and when the rule was when the bankruptcy petition is filed, no pre-petition debt gets paid, and the automatic stay prevents anybody from taking any action, so on. So the people at the company really didn't know how to implement those two ideas, and I spent a lot of time on the ground directing them in what the legal requirements were, including management of cash, which is always a sensitive issue in a bankruptcy, and just other operational issues that came up, transactions in or out of the ordinary course of business and when court orders were required, and so on. That was the early stages of the case, and then I morphed into becoming the assistant to Herman Glatt, who was the senior partner on the case at the time, in drafting the reorganization plan and, to some degree, the disclosure statement.
I'm intrigued by the early part of the case when you said the day-to-day management, and this is the day before first day orders where you had a lot of cash management issues that it sounds like they were new to you. I don't know how to formulate this. Is this the kind of thing that you think that nobody thought of during the drafting of the code, or that people did think of and decided they'd just leave to another day?
No, this was absolutely thought of during the code because there was the practice under old chapter XI, Roman numeral 11, where a bankruptcy petition was filed. Pre-petition bills simply were not paid. There were no such things as critical vendors, or there were critical vendors, but nobody used the concept. And the bankruptcy court took jurisdiction of all of the assets and prohibited payment of any pre-petition obligations. And that's just how it was done, and it was that was an underlying assumption of the code that was nowhere stated. And the growth in critical vendor orders, I think, is a result of that concept not having been stated anywhere explicitly. You can decide whether that's good or bad, but at least at the time of the drafting, nobody ever thought that courts would issue orders allowing selective payment of pre-petition debt.
I'm amused to listen to you talk about the old line that that the guy that writes the statute ought to be doomed to enforce it. And in a way, you were doomed to enforce it or interpret or understand your own statute. Isn't that right?
Yeah, and perhaps I knew it too well. You know, in retrospect, I can say probably I would have been a lot more flexible in enforcing the statute had I not known what was intended or what the thought was.
I don't know if I
helped my clients or hurt them.
How did you like your own handiwork, having written and then being stuck to enforce it?
I was okay with it at the time. The real answer to that question, though, has come with close to 30 or over 25 years of perspective that, looking back now, I really like it. And I'm very happy with what the large group of people who were involved in putting that statute together did. It was an extraordinary piece of work, and it worked very well. And I've been involved in a few years ago with the World Bank. There was a fellow at the World Bank, a really talented guy named Gordon Johnson, who was running all over the world on behalf of the World Bank, trying to persuade developing countries and even developed countries that having a good reorganization scheme was a good idea and would really help their economies. And there's good evidence that that is in fact true. And the model that he was using and the World Bank was using and that every country around the world that was adopting these things was some variation of Chapter 11. So with all of the key principles implemented in different ways, of course, for local culture and local sensibilities and what people could tolerate under local law, but the basic concept of reorganization as provided under Chapter 11, and I think we did a pretty good job on it now that I look back. I was too close at the time to make that decision then.
Rich, I've chatted with you off and on over the years about your practice, and when you do talk about your career, the case that always comes up is public service in New Hampshire.
Yeah, that too was an opportunity of a lifetime. Again, just being in the right place at the right time. Peter Sellers in one of his great movies said half of life is just showing up.
Winning is showing up, yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Well, let me get the date right here. Would this be about 1985?
1988. It was filed in January of 88.
88. So you're maturing into a grown-up lawyer at this point, right?
Well, yeah. You know, everything's relative. I thought I was grown up at the time, but now 18 years later,
yeah,
I realized I was pretty young.
Okay. So let's talk about public service in New Hampshire. What's that story?
Public service New Hampshire was the first major, maybe any, investor-owned utility to file a bankruptcy case since the 1930s, the Great Depression. The Public Utility Holding Company Act and some of the reforms that had been enacted in the 1930s prevented utilities from getting into financial trouble for a long, long time. And then along came nuclear power. And nuclear power plants were very expensive to build and took a long time and had a lot of regulatory hurdles. But quite a number of them were built through the 50s and 60s and even through the 70s. And then in 1979, I think it was, there was an accident at Three Mile Island nuclear power plant in Pennsylvania. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission immediately got a whole lot stricter and slower, and a lot of anti-nuclear activists got much more involved and now had a poster child for their campaign. As a result, the nuclear power plant being built by Public Service New Hampshire in Seabrook, New Hampshire, which was, I think at that point, under construction or maybe it was just coming off the drawing boards, took a lot longer to build than anybody had anticipated. And as of 1988, when the case began, it had still not become operational. In the meantime, the legislature of the great state of New Hampshire, in its infinite wisdom, had passed a law which prohibited the utility from passing through to ratepayers any part of the cost of a plant that was still under construction. So to keep its 35 or thereabouts percent interest in Seabrook alive and going, Public Service New Hampshire had to fund the cost of construction, the cost of carry, and all of the interest expense associated with that by additional equity financing and borrowings in the public financial markets, which it did for many, many years until late 1987. The financial markets finally closed up on it and said, we're not giving you any more. The last issue of debt they got was something if I get this right, it had an interest rate of somewhere around 16 or 18%, accelerating every year until it was paid off. It bumped by 2% a year until it was paid off.
16, 18%.
Yeah, and it was extraordinarily expensive money. And then
this is the late 80s, so it's long after the high rates of the early 80s.
Exactly, exactly. And finally,
it was real money then.
It was real money. Yeah. And finally, they said, we can't do this anymore. They were about to default on one of their bond issues, and they filed a Chapter 11 case in January of 88, filed by a really extraordinary scholar of bankruptcy law and a great bankruptcy lawyer named Charles Normandin of Ropes and Gray. But he and his firm were not in a position to handle a debtor case of this magnitude, and the company went and interviewed some other firms to do this, and I was on the team at Stubman that went to the interview, and we got the assignment, and I was tapped by Stubman to go move to New England for 2 years.
Well, you pulled up stakes and gave up Los Angeles for Boston then, didn't you?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And ran that case. And it was fascinating because it had the interaction of, first of all, it was a big complex case. There hadn't been that many big complex cases in the 80s. There were some. You know, you can look at LTV and Braniff and one or two other airlines. I think Continental and Manville had filed. So it wasn't unique in the sense that, or early in the sense that ITEL was, but it was extraordinary in the interaction between the bankruptcy law and the utility regulatory law. And as Judge Yakos, Jim Yakos was the judge, a really excellent judge, used to write a monthly review called the Broken Bench Review, which was well respected in bankruptcy circles. He pointed out the circularity of valuation and rate setting. Rate setting was to some degree based on valuation, and valuation in the bankruptcy court was to some degree based on the rates.
The guys that get over the fence by climbing on each other's shoulders.
That's right. That's right. And so it was a very complex and difficult case, and it had the overlay of politics as well, because the customers were three quarters of the population of the state of New Hampshire who voted for their legislators. And the legislature, through the regulatory process, had tremendous control over this company. And the governor at the time was John Sununu, the father of the current
senator. We have to stipulate it's the other John Sununu, right?
Right, right. Who was just leaving at the time to become the chief of staff of George the First. So very politically sensitive case. It had all those overlays in it, so it was quite unique. There were two or three other investor-owned utility companies cases filed after that, but that was the first since the Great Depression.
Rejoin the ABI podcast after this break for current news in bankruptcy. This Week in Bankruptcy features another skirmish over the significance of medical debts. Are healthcare costs a leading cause of financial failures? A group of Harvard academics, led by Professor Elizabeth Warren, take issue with what they consider distortion of their data on medical bankruptcies. Two researchers from the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern, funded by the healthcare industry, challenged the claim that medical costs cause nearly half of all bankruptcies, a claim made last year by the Harvard study. Professor Warren and her colleagues from the Harvard Medical School stand by their argument that bankruptcies affect mainly middle-class, privately insured families. And they say evidence from the debtors themselves points to rising medical costs as a leading cause in about half the cases filed today. Now back to this week's ABI podcast. This has been John Hartgen for the ABI.
I guess we can agree that when people talk about Chapter 11, whether it works or not, or there's the question of empirically whether what it does and how it does it, but there's also the question of what it means to work in this context. Let me ask you, do you think Public Service of New Hampshire was a success? And if so, what makes it a success? What counts as success in Chapter 11?
I think somebody said success has many fathers and failure is an orphan. The analogy here is in Chapter 11, success has many forms, but there's only one kind of failure. I think failure means that the company winds up being liquidated in a bricks and mortar sale. The employees are all dismissed. The assets are sold off piecemeal. That's a failure in a Chapter 11. Chapter 11 is designed to preserve value, and that kind of a outcome doesn't really preserve value. A success is some form of preserving value and preserving the going concern.
But if the going concern value is less than the liquidation value, isn't liquidation a success?
Well, it might be a success, but you don't need Chapter 11 for that. You can do that in Chapter 7. And you don't, in some sense, you don't even need bankruptcy unless you want to try and make fair distribution. If all the assets are lien, the secured creditor can just foreclose on it and sell it how it wishes. In any event, was public service a success? I think so, yeah. There were two competing plans in that case. One was sponsored by the debtor with the creditors committee support, and another was an acquisition plan sponsored by the equity committee. The equity committee and acquirer plan ultimately won. So did PS&H lose? No, I don't think so. PS&H continued as a utility, continued as a separate legal entity, and more importantly, PS&H's shareholders received a distribution at the end of the case, somewhere around $500 million, at a time when, or it was 2 years after the case was filed, or 2.5 years, when the case was filed, the Wall Street Journal reported that the likely value of PS&H was somewhere between $400 to $600 million less than the debt that was owing by the company. So there was over $1 billion swing in value during the course of the 2 years, and I consider that a success, even though PS&H's plan wasn't the one that was ultimately confirmed.
As I listened to you talk, I remember the protest against the nuclear plant and the Clamshell Alliance in New Hampshire. And I'm wondering, can you sing the Clamshell Alliance theme song?
No, I never heard it.
Never
I can't recall that I did.
Can't handle that, okay.
Can you sing it, Jeff?
Pardon?
Can you sing it?
Yes, but this isn't my interview, so I better... Look, this is wonderful, and I know there are a bunch of other items that we could go through here, but one thing we certainly ought to get to is, I know you've written some lately about Chapter 11 and how it's understood today and how it's changed, and I gather you don't fully approve of the way Chapter 11 has changed over the years.
No. One thing I learned when working on the 78 code was, and it's been reinforced by my experience over the years, is that to nobody's surprise, creditors and their lawyers play in bankruptcy cases day in, day out, year after year. Debtors don't. Debtors, for the most part, show up once, some cases twice. This is both consumer and corporate debtors, and don't have much experience at it. And the creditors get to write the documents because of what many in this world call the golden rule. That is, he who has the gold makes the rules. So the lenders get to write the terms on which they're willing to lend money. Over time, they learn what works and what doesn't to protect their interests in the case of financial failure, and they write their documents better and better and better. And over the years, they get really good at it. The 1978 code had the effect of unbalancing all of those creditor expectations that had been built up in the 40 years since the last major revision of the bankruptcy laws, and in the 15 or 18 years since the widespread adoption of the Uniform Commercial Code, and somewhat leveled the playing field to permit reorganizations. Now, in some sense, it's not debtor against creditor. It's creditor against creditor in a reorganization because there's usually not enough money to go around. But the debtor is at the center of that creditor versus creditor battle and has to have some leverage to maintain some balance so that the company can be preserved or the value can be preserved. Well, creditors get good at this over time, and they get really good to the point where at least some player in the process, usually the secured lender, has the ability to say, I'm going to take all my marbles and go home and not play this game with you. So over the first 25, 26 years of the bankruptcy code experience, that happened, no surprise, and it's a reasonable thing for creditors to be doing. But when the 2005 amendments were adopted, instead of re-leveling the playing field, they went in the opposite direction, and they gave creditors even more than they had been getting. Creditors' experience in bankruptcy cases is that they lose money. And when they've got the clout, they go to Congress and say, I don't want to lose money. So Congress puts in provisions that causes them to lose less money, which means that it's going to be harder to reorganize, because if you've got 10 different groups of creditors in a given case and each one is entitled to more, that doesn't create more value. All it does is create more fighting over what limited value there is and give one creditor perhaps an advantage over the others, and doesn't give the debtor any leverage. Well, Congress, instead of leveling the playing field, tilted it further. And I think reorganizations are going to become more difficult and more costly, and less likely to preserve value.
Can I try to operationalize this in a way and invite you to respond? You may not buy any of this, but I'll give you a pitch and you'll tell me why you don't buy it. My impression was that in the 70s, when the code was new, there was a general perception that a purpose, maybe a dominant purpose of Chapter 11, was to give old equity owners a second bite at the apple and a chance to salvage the equity position, even if that came at the expense of creditors, and that may have been an error all along, that it may have been that the real purpose of Chapter 11 was to preserve asset values, which is a concept quite distinct from preserving equity values. And what may have happened is that we've changed from equity to assets. Now, it's your talk, so you tell me why I'm wrong.
I don't think you're wrong. There's two issues here. One is you always want to preserve asset values, and I think the 78 code contemplated that as a goal. But once you preserve the asset values, how do you divide them up? There were some who argued, as under old Chapter 10, that the absolute priority rule should apply, and value should be divided from the top, distributed from the top down in accordance with absolute priorities. There were some who argued for a relative priority rule. The theory was that under non-bankruptcy law, absolute priority applied, and creditors were entitled to be paid in accordance with their priorities. The counter-argument was that a company was under no obligation to stay in business. It could file a Chapter 7, or in those days a straight bankruptcy, and liquidate at any time, which would wipe out lots of value. So creditors would not get that extra going concern value if the company stayed alive. So the question became, who's entitled to the going concern bonus or premium? Was it the creditors who would get it under absolute priority, or was it the shareholders who made the decision to keep the company alive rather than putting it out of its misery? And there's no correct answer to that question. So the code was set up to permit a negotiated resolution that equity would get something in exchange for preserving the value for the debt. Over the years, that rationale has really shifted, and creditors, as I say, get good at collecting money. It's their job, and they get expert at it. And as a result, I think the sensibilities have shifted to say more toward the absolute priority model. But the code accommodates both outcomes. And since it's shifted to the absolute priority model, the main focus now is preserving and maximizing asset value rather than the division, dividing the going concern premium.
Do you think the code does a good job of preserving asset values?
It has done a good job. I think the 2005 amendments cut against that. If various groups of creditors like real estate lessors and personal property lessors and intellectual property licensors are allowed to take back their interest in the company and thereby pull out key value maximizers in the company. You take away the company's lease, what's it got? You take away its intellectual property license, what has it got? What's left of the value? In the amendments giving more power to those groups to take their piece of the reorganization pie and leave, I think really will damage the maximization of value. There's the irony in it, that as the policy has shifted more toward maximization of value and away from division of the going concern premium, Congress has taken a step back from maximizing value.
Let me try a summary, and I'm improvising now here, and I'm not sure I'll get it right, but it seems to me that maybe what you're saying is that the 78 code was concerned with preserving asset values and with preserving equity positions, that it somehow lost its capacity to preserve equity positions, and now it may be losing its capacity to preserve asset values. Have I got that right?
I'm You got it almost right. I'm not sure the 78 code was concerned with preserving equity positions. It was more concerned with giving an incentive to get a deal done. There are a lot of provisions in the bankruptcy code that force parties to a deal. One, in fact, there's a sometime bankruptcy scholar and practitioner named Richard Brody who wrote an article in 1984 thereabouts in The Business Lawyer called Chapter 11, The Settlement Imperative. And the idea was that there are a lot of provisions that are designed to force parties to the negotiating table because there was no correct answer that could be built into the statute that answered the division of going concern premium question. And at one point during the drafting, Ken Klee and I said, well, how will we get parties to the table? How do we get them to negotiate? That was a continual theme as we were discussing. At one point we said, we know the answer, that if the parties can't agree, then the decision will be given to a postmaster third class to decide, and people would be worried enough about the outcome of that decision that they would all come to an agreement, meaning no disrespect to the Postal Service, of course. In any event, so it wasn't so much to preserve equity interests, but rather, look, in 1978, we were dealing with a lot more closely held corporations, private companies, in bankruptcy than the big public companies we've seen over the last 15 or 18 years or so. And the equity owners were the management. You had to give the management an incentive to stay around to get to the reorganization table early and to get it done before all value was lost. So this was giving equity value was a way of preserving and maximizing the value of the enterprise. For example, under old Chapter 10, management never wanted to see a bankruptcy case filed because a trustee was appointed and management was out. They'd be signing their own death warrant. So we took away that mandatory appointment of a trustee to make it easier for a company to decide to use reorganization and to get on with it rather than waiting until it was too late.
Rich, this is wonderful. I could go on at it all day, but you've got a living to make, and we may have lost our audience at this point.
Probably so.
Thank you very much for taking the time.
Pleasure, Jack. Good to be on here.
You've been listening to one of a series of podcasts that we are producing here at the ABI to help us all understand better how bankruptcy professionals do their work. We hope you have found it helpful. Look on our website at abiworld.org for more podcast choices. Thank you for listening.